Okay, so it's great to be here with people, some or many of whom I assume are Howie Cohen fans. I admit to being a Howie Cohen fan for a long time. And I'm going to talk about kind of confidence in the practice and our aspirations in the practice. But I was started off on this and got inspired by one of the really pithy teachings that Howie gives that I has guided me many times. Just really super pithy, really short. And he sometimes says, the way out is through. And that's just guided me so many times. It's something that's always true. I've never encountered a moment where the way out has not been through. It's just a shorthand way of saying that we have to meet our experience, meet it with mindfulness and loving kindness rather than being averse to it or avoiding it in order to be free, in order to be truly free. The way out is through what's here right now. And although it's one of those pithy, seemingly always true statements, it's a difficult one to really always remember. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about that. I love it for a number of reasons, but one of them is it encapsulated in that little statement is that there is a way out, right? There's the third noble truth in there, in addition to some other things, just in that short sentence. The third noble truth being, for anybody who's not familiar, it's always good to just kind of think through them again anyway, even if you are. The first noble truth being there is stress or discomfort, fragility, suffering in life. Not that everything is suffering, but that there is that in life, that we all encounter it, that it's complicated and it's to be understood. So the first noble truth is actually part of our practice is we're understanding that. And then the second noble truth is that the origin of the suffering and the disease that we experience with is craving. And the third noble truth is there is a cessation of craving. It's there's a cessation of the suffering, the disease, and it's the letting go of that craving. And so that's the third noble truth. The fourth noble truth is that there's a path and it involves our ethics, it involves our meditation, our mind training, and it involves Sila, Samadhi, Panya, wisdom, wise view, understanding the truth of the way things are. So, in that little short saying, there's a way out. There's a cessation of suffering and disease. And so it's kind of paradoxical. I mean, in a way, in that little statement that that Howie gives every once in a while, he may have gotten it from someone else. I don't know. Dharma teachers cycle in a lot of stuff. But it's kind of paradoxical, the way out is through, and he encapsulates, that little statement encapsulates something that Ajahn Chah said also really concisely, but in a little bit more complicated or complex way. Ajahn Chah, great master of the Thai forest tradition, teacher of our teachers, teacher of Jack Kornfield, et cetera, said this: there are two kinds of suffering, the suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you are not willing to face the second kind of suffering, you will surely continue to experience the first. So the way out is through. So we turn towards our difficulties. Yeah, we turn towards our difficulties. I've heard Howie say it that way too. So in order to do this, to be truly mindful, to meet our experiences, to relate to our experience in a really different way that will lead us towards a lot more ease and peace in life, we need to have some fearlessness, some courage, and lots of love, lots of compassion, lots of compassion for our experience. Compassion for the fact that we're sensitive beings, and we do have all of these sense doors that are wide open all the time. The five that we're familiar with, and then the mind sense door, and there's pleasant, unpleasant experiences impacting them all the time. We don't have control over that process. but we can relate to our experience differently. So in this process of the way out is through, we need to have a lot of love and compassion for the fact that we're all in that boat together, actually. You know? So we need to have this courage and this love, because a lot of what stands in the way of our ability to meet our experience is some level of fear. Sometimes it can be a low level of fear, but it's really kind of persistent. And that's why they say the practice is simple but not easy, right? It's like, oh, the way out is through. Well, I'll just meet this experience right now with loving awareness. But it's not so easy. It's simple but not easy, right? And we have these fears. We have fear of experiencing physical sensations. It's like, oh, it's uncomfortable. We have a lot of just fear around that, really basic. And fear of certain emotions. And we can each, in our own different patterning conditions, have developed, you know, not really wanting to face particular emotions that we have. We can have fear of seeing the truth of impermanence. And it's said that fear is actually the root of, and check this out in your own experience. I'm still checking it out. I heard this teaching and I'm still checking it out. Fear is the root of all the hindrances. So there are 5 hindrances to mindful awareness. I just held up 4 fingers and said 5. There are 5 hindrances. And they are wanting something to be different right now, so greed. Wanting something. Not wanting what's happening right now, so aversion. There's many manifestations of that, from anger to fear to impatience to frustration. Restlessness and worry. Sleepiness. Or dullness, which is called sloth and torpor, and doubt, skeptical doubt about one's own ability to do the practice, or about the practice, the teachers, the teachings. And all of these can get in the way, basically, are just the obscurations of our mindful awareness. They obscure our ability to see things as they are right now. And it's said that the root of all of them is fear. And it's fear, you know, it's fear of, as I mentioned, truth, seeing the truth of impermanence. But sometimes if we really let go into mindfulness, mindful awareness, and we meet our experience, we let go into it, and we have this kind of really deep intimacy with what's happening right now, we see it start to slip away, and it shows us how our identities are made up, how we're taking these ephemeral experiences, these thoughts, to be ourselves, when they're just slipping away. So we have this, we're kind of turning away from that through our hindrances. I had a kind of a seeing into this aspect of our experience, that fear is really kind of at the root of seeing the truth of the way things are. Once when I was on retreat, I went through a really, this is not my normal, typical mode of practice, but I was like, this is over, I can't do it anymore. I was like, it's too hard. I cannot meet this experience. It was like 13 years into my practice. I was in the middle of a 3-month retreat. And, you know, there are stages of the practice that they call rolling up the mat stages. It's like, I'm rolling this up and I'm out of here. Because it's just too hard. And I believed in that moment. I had solidified totally ephemeral experience into an idea of myself as unable to do it. And I went, but I was like feeling like so good. I was like, I'm out of here. Don't have to do it anymore. but I was just so used to sitting. I went up to my room. I'm like, I'm leaving tomorrow. But I sat in my room on my cushion, and I was just doing some more mindfulness, because that's what I had been doing for a really long time. And I was like, oh, this feels really good. I'm leaving tomorrow. It feels really good. Everything in the body and the mind feels incredibly great. Oh, I feel so good. Except for this, like, feeling right here. This feeling right here. And as soon as I brought mindful awareness to that, it was like fear. Just fear. And as soon as I brought the mindful awareness to that actual fear that was underlying the whole doubt story about myself that I couldn't do it, the doubt actually disappeared. I knew exactly what I was doing. I knew that I was continuing with the practice as I always had, that it was the most important thing, that I knew how it was free, you know, how it was the only way to actually relate to my experience, that I had known that for years, and the doubt disappeared, and it was just, all I had to do was notice the fear underneath. And I really had no idea it was there. It was literally following a physical sensation. That was the only place in my experience that I found that was like slightly uncomfortable at that time. So it was really kind of a strong message for me too, that it wasn't personal. That these stories we make up of ourselves, that story was standing in the way. It was something trying to stop me from seeing more clearly me, whatever. It was just a hindrance, just a passing mind state. Totally believed it, totally bought it for a little while. That's why I like, as a way of having courage, bringing courage to the practice, being able to meet experience when it's difficult, this phrase, "I see you, Mara." I don't know how many people here. Sometimes Mara gets left out of our teachings in our lay teaching convert communities. Mara, in the teachings, in the suttas, embodies, is the being who's embodies all the hindrances and defilements in the mind. So when one is visited by hindrances like of greed or aversion, what is Mara in the mind? Mara trying to keep you from being awakened. Mara trying to keep you from seeing more of the truth of the way things are. Mara trying to keep you standing in the way of you and peace, and seeing it, and seeing peace, and experiencing it. And I find that metaphor, that visual, very, very helpful personally. Because that's what it feels like. It feels like being visited by something else. It's not personal, these hindrances that we experience, like the doubt. It's being visited by Mara. So we can say, and it's there's sort of suttas like this where there's something standing in your way. It's fear, it's aversion, it's greed, it's just restlessness, it's a pattern, it's a pattern of judgment that you experience all the time, something, some kind of self-judgment or self-demeaning thought, or so you know, your visitors, your frequent visitors, who are the frequent visitors of your mind that keep you entangled more frequently, you know. You can say, "I see you, Mara," and see through the lack of substantiality of that experience. So for example, if, you know, maybe there's a pattern of anxiety or stress at work. "I see you, Mara." Something like that. It's one way to kind of meet our experience and to see that the way out is through, to cut through some of the false notions that we have that keep us bound up in suffering, or at least in the patterns that we have. Other things that give us courage kind of in the practice. Well, one of them is really verified faith. It's like, what keeps us coming back when we see the practice working? That's the kind of faith or confidence in the practice that the practice points to. The Buddha said, "Ehi pasiko," come and see for yourself. So come and see for yourself if the practice works, you know? And oftentimes if you're coming back to some sanghas, if you're coming back for sitting, that's because there's some verified faith there, and it can be really helpful to review that. You know, what have I seen in the practice? What's brought me back? Because sometimes we may discount the significance of some of what we've experienced in the practice. But it's keeping us going. There's also this experience that's sometimes translated as spiritual urgency, which is an interesting word from the language of that the Buddha's teachings were written down in. It's called samvega. And samvega is this sense that the ways of the world that are pointing us towards, oh, you're going to get happiness this way. You know, you're going to get happiness by doing lots more shopping, or making sure that nothing unpleasant gets in the way. You know, that particular sweater that you saw online that you've been remembering over and over again, if you have that, that's going to be good. It's, Samvega is a kind of a, it's a turning away from that. It's a realization that that those things are not what's going to bring us happiness. So a lot of us come to the practice with that underlying sense that we haven't, what we've been told is the way out is not the way out. The way, and we have a sense that actually the way out has to be relating to experience in a different way than the dominant culture has taught us, that we've been conditioned to practice, and that the way out, and what we come here and we find out, and it resonates with us that the way out is actually through. The way out is to relate to our experience differently. It's not to just grab at more and more pleasant experiences, or to just push away at everything that's unpleasant. And then we hear Howie saying it, and this gives us a lot more courage and a lot more, which points to another thing that gives us a lot of courage and fearlessness to practice this, to meet our experience, to see again and again that the way out is through, that it's Sangha, it's community, it's like-minded friends, and it's teachers, and it's hearing the Dhamma. A great gift. I've come here for years and heard the Dhamma and many other places. And so incredibly grateful for that. We're really lucky we get to hear the Dhamma. There is a sutta saying that there's two causes for the arising of wise view. Appropriate attention and the words of another. So this is a relational practice in that way. It gives that we can mirror for each other that the way out is through, and that we have the courage, we have the internal capacity to do it, because we all do. There's no question about it. There's also another, the reason I like to use the Pali words from the suttas, it's because I really strongly believe that the practice requires us to decondition ourselves culturally. We have a lot of erroneous cultural messages that are playing out, describing ourselves inaccurately to us, describing each other inaccurately, describing the relationship, the world, the way that we should relate to our experience in order to be happy or not, or in order to be kind. So I like to use the Pali words because a lot of them have meanings that we don't actually have meanings for in the English language. The practice is actually countercultural. It's against the stream. So I bring in another little Pali word. It's called chanda. And it's a zeal for the practice. There's actually unhealthy desire in chanda. But in this context, I'm talking about the chanda, the zeal for the practice that can arise. I was just on a retreat, silent. I was assistant teaching a 5-day meditation retreat with actually Howie was there. And nothing else could bring people to be silent for a week, meditating, doing mindfulness practice, sitting, walking, zeal for the practice. It's a beautiful thing. And one of the things to do is just kind of identify it. It's important to notice our wholesome mental states when our aspirations are going in a certain direction that's actually leading us in a direction where we're going to have a lot more true happiness in life in that direction. Chanda is not striving. Zeal is not, it's not like trying to get something, but it's just this zeal for the practice. There's this beautiful, another sutta passage. I think this one's really quite accessible. It's pretty famous. It's about crossing the flood of all of our difficult experiences, the through part, what we have to go through in order to open ourselves up to more happiness and ease. Someone asked the Buddha, how do you cross the flood? How do you cross that flood? So how do you awaken through that flood of difficulty? And the Buddha says, by not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood. And the practitioner asks, but how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you crossed the flood? And the Buddha said, when I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I crossed the flood. So we meet our experience, and that references how we meet our experience with mindful awareness, without struggling with it, pushing it away. But we aren't at a standstill. We're practicing, we're moving forward. And by that, and through that, we can cross the flood. So we have our personal aspirations and our motivations that fire our practice also and can bring us courage in the practice to meet our experience. When I've had difficulties in the practice, it's come to me almost in a way, I've just remembered something personally, that how the women in my family have been prevented for generations from trying to achieve their aspirations. My grandmother was married at the age of about probably 14 or 13 on one side of my family. And then the second generation, the women couldn't go to college. That would be my aunts. And then, and this is my side of my family that's in India. And then my own generation, there were a lot of women who married my cousins who were prevented from working. And I often just thought of the fact that, you know, in this world, actually everybody in this room, often, even those struggling with some difficult circumstances, we have some serious abilities, capacities. We can come here, we can hear the Dhamma, we have that freedom, first of all, in this society. Many of us as women, we have a tremendous amount more freedom than the women in the rest of the world. But it was just a fire that lit on me. It's like, I have this ability, you know, I have more freedom, so I'm going to use it. And when I would come up against some difficulty, particularly in the practice, I would say, no, I'm not going to give up. Because there are so many people I know, and it's, you know, I'm just talking about particular women in my family, but there are so many people who have really tremendous obstacles of extreme poverty or extreme deprivation, you know, lack of education. They're just trying to make it by minute by minute. And we have this possibility. So you know what? The way out is also the way of coming alive. I believe that in the practice, that the practice is very empowering. The way out is through, and the way out is coming alive. It's one way of describing it. I really have been guided by this quote too. It's by Howard Thurman, the great civil rights leader. He had a huge role to play in San Francisco. I think his church is still going. Yeah. Howard Thurman, and Noemi's probably heard this quote from me too many times because she comes to this other group and I say it all the time. Don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because the world needs people who have come alive. Don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because the world needs people who have come alive. Howard Thurman. So it's an expression of his, you know, aspiration. And it's interesting because we come to this practice, we kind of know we're not fully alive. We're not fully alive. I mean, for one thing, we're not aware so much of the time, right? It's kind of amazing how much we go through life and we're not aware. It's like, and there's that disease, that sense of, that's that samvega. Oh my God, that's I was referring to previously, that sense that the way we're operating in life is really not going in the right direction. And that we're not really having the strategies for whatever strategies we're using and we've been taught to use for happiness are not quite the right ones. So we see it's like, I'm not even aware all the time. How can I be alive? And that lack of awareness, it puts just a veil over our perceptions so that we don't see the truths of impermanence. We're not kind of connected with that, the truths of the fragility of life and how important every moment is because of the fragility of life, how incredibly important our intentions are. We're not fully connected with that. We're not fully connected with our hearts. Since we're not aware so much of the time, we're not fully connected with our bodies. We have that sense, many of us, that we're not quite embodied. So this practice, by literally just placing us in awareness in our bodies with what's happening in our mind right now, instead of avoiding it all the time, we know, kind of in a way, deeply, we're not quite alive because we're not in touch with that. Really starts to, can really empower us. It can also cut through. Once we turn our attention to some of these limiting thoughts about ourselves and check them out and see how frequently they arise, no matter, you know, and actually, you know, have the courage that I was talking about before, the fearlessness, and part of which comes from continuing verified faith, being with like-minded people, hearing the teachings over and over, our own personal messages that give us courage. Because of that, we can start to see, you know, maybe how frequently the kind of limiting self-views arise, the total insubstantiality of them. They come together and then they fall apart. Like I was talking about the doubt story I had. I can't do it. That whole story came together. It was so solid. It was so real. And it fell and disintegrated. And these happen over and over. The more we're with our experience, we can see these limiting self-views, these demeaning thoughts sometimes, or just difficult circumstances that come up in the mind and emotions that recur, repetitive thoughts, we start to see through them. You know, nothing that is so ephemeral and slipping away can actually define us. We cannot be reduced to some thought in the mind in a fleeting moment. We kind of build these the substantiality around it, a solidity around them that has actually no basis in reality in real time. So yeah, and part of the reason I feel like the practice makes us come alive too is because a lot of these limiting self-views we're colonized, our thoughts are kind of colonized by dominant culture, you know? Some of us get messages that we're less worthy than others. Can you believe that we even get messages like our bodies are not supposed to be the way they are? I mean, this is absurd. It's so absurd, but so many of us are so wrapped up in it. It's like, oh, if my stomach's too big, this is a really bad thing. I mean, this is the way in which we're entrapped. And so the practice, you know, can help us see. If that's the thought, like, stomach's too big, over and over again, if that's we're seeing that in the mind, we're seeing it pass away, and we actually connect with the harm of what's actually occurring there, and we have a lot of compassion for the experience, we can see that it actually can't define us, and there's nothing to this. First of all, this stomach is changing every single second. Every single second. And the thought of it passes away. Yes, another Howie, another Howieism. A thought of your mother is not your mother. The thought of your stomach is not your stomach. A thought is just a thought. And then we look into that and see through it, through the practice. So we can connect with our aspirations to come alive. It's kind of it's there for all of us. Like I said, we kind of all know. Because in coming alive, we start to understand we start to see through our views. We also start to see the truth, this truth of impermanence more. and the impersonality of those limiting views. So what is your highest intention is kind of what I'd kind of like to leave, kind of like to close with. You know, if we really took the words of Howard Thurman to mind, and we really took the words of Howie Cohn to mind, the two Howards, the way out is through, and ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because the world needs people who have come alive. So it's for you, it's for the world. You know, what is your highest intention with the practice, and what keeps you coming back? And what gives you courage? And why did you come? Why did you come tonight? It's good to reflect, to have these reflections, and not to just kind of try again, to just sit and be with the breath, but to have a sense of ourselves within the practice, our intentions, our aspirations, what gives us courage, what makes us come alive, how we might come alive. The practice is the whole package of ethics and loving kindness, mind training through meditation, community, sangha, simplicity, and caring for each other in our communities. So those reflections are also good, and I just kind of wanted to share that. We have just a couple minutes. If anybody has any questions, we can take just a couple, if not. Mm-hmm. Hi. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was exactly what I was feeling. And so my question is more, can you provide some more details on how you actually come to recognize that and make more room?
That's a really interesting and wise little phrase that you used, make more room for it. So yeah, I've had many difficult sits here. And restlessness is an interesting experience because of, yeah, underneath it is there often is fear. So one way to make more room for it is to name or label the feeling. So it might be restlessness, or you might actually just be directly sitting with fear. So just a gentle, really gentle label, restlessness. And with difficult emotions or difficult hindrances like restlessness, a little bit of a longer label is often really helpful for people. It's like, restlessness feels like this. Restlessness feels like this. And it kind of makes that space and that openness. And the space of disidentifying with it. It's not my restlessness. You know, you're not owning it, but it's just restlessness as a sort of an object, right? It feels like this. And then often it's really helpful first to be with it in the body, because that's not sometimes less difficult. Like, how does it feel like this? And then there's, and then what's the tone or the texture in the mind? And then really, if it's something really difficult, it's important to know that you can titrate with it. That's not cheating at all. In other words, restlessness feels like this, and you can stay with it for a while. But if there comes a point where it's just you feel like it can't be tolerated, you can turn the attention to something that's kind of neutral or pleasant in the body, which there usually is something like that, like warm feelings of the hands touching or something that's kind of neutral or pleasant. And then you can go back to it when you have the capacity and the resource to go back to that experience. And it's literally, it is like making room, making space. It's creating that disidentifying space and just making the space for it. And also with certain experiences, there are some kind of antidotes or little tricks. With restlessness, I like to, as a one thing that's helpful is to kind of bring the awareness to a heavy part in the body, like the heaviness of the bones, something that feels really settled, the heaviness of the bones in the legs, that feeling or sensation. It's all mindfulness. If even if you turn away from the restlessness, the difficult emotion for a while, or the difficult experience, and then go back to it, this is one of the ways. And then there's the RAIN acronym. Recognize the experience, so you can use a label there. Accept and allow it. Inquire a little bit into it, which is that, what does it feel like in the body? How does it feel in the mind? That's all the inquiry, really. And the non-identification, you know, it's not mine, it's not my restlessness. Okay, so thank you everyone so much. It was fun. Next week is Howie! He's back! Woo! The way out is through. 'Dedicating the merit quickly. Many benefit that arises from our practice today together, the practice of mindfulness, the practice of hearing the Dhamma and being in community together, practice of being quiet and still and secluding our minds so that we can be better people to ourselves and to the world. Many merit that arises from this practice be shared with all beings. May it serve to awaken all beings. Thanks. If you could put the chairs to the side, that's great. It helps. I think stack them over on that side. It helps for the people who use the room tomorrow.
Since I got back, and I still have the chest pains, and I still have the pains across it as well, which actually saw a doctor on.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
But now, I'm a little worried because during, like, you get deeper and deeper,
yeah.
And I almost like feel like I've started to train my body to experience stress because I was feeling very stressed during those last 3 days.
Yeah.
And so I would wake up and I was stressed, and my bed was stressed, and like throughout my entire days, like I feel more stressed.
More stressed now after your retreat.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And you know, I do feel more focused, and I do feel a bit happier, which are the good things, but I definitely don't feel that positive.